Random House Audio presents Dreams from My Father, a story of race and inheritance by Barack Obama. Read for you by the author.
Almost a decade has passed since this book was first published. The opportunity to write the book came when I was in law school, the result of my election as the first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review. In the wake of some modest publicity, I received an advance from a publisher and went to work with the belief that the story of my family and my efforts to understand that story might speak in some way to the fissures of race that have characterized the American experience, as well as the fluid state of identity, the leaps through time, the collision of cultures that mark our modern life. Like most first-time authors, I was filled with hope and despair upon the book's publication. Hope that the book might succeed beyond my youthful dreams, despair that I had failed to say anything worth saying. The reality fell somewhere in between. The reviews were mildly favorable. People actually showed up at the readings that my publisher arranged. The sales were underwhelming. And after a few months, I went on with the business of my life, certain that my career as an author would be short-lived, but glad to have survived the process with my dignity more or less intact. I had little time for reflection over the next 10 years. I ran a voter registration project in the 1992 election cycle, began a civil rights practice, and started teaching constitutional law at the University of Chicago. My wife and I bought a house, were blessed with two gorgeous, healthy, and mischievous daughters, and struggled to pay the bills. When a seat in the state legislature opened up in 1996, some friends persuaded me to run for the office, and I won. I had been warned before taking office that state politics lacks the glamour of its Washington counterpart. One labors largely in obscurity, mostly on topics that mean a great deal to some, but that the average man or woman on the street can safely ignore. The regulation of mobile homes, say, or the tax consequences of farm equipment depreciation. Nevertheless, I found the work satisfying, mostly because the scale of state politics allows for concrete results, an expansion of health insurance for poor children, or a reform of the laws that send innocent men to death row, within a meaningful time frame. And two, because within the Capitol building of a big industrial state, one sees every day the face of a nation in constant conversation. Inner-city mothers and corn and bean farmers, immigrant day laborers alongside suburban investment bankers, all jostling to be heard, all ready to tell their stories. A few months ago, I won a seat as the United States Senator from Illinois. It was a difficult race in a crowded field of well-funded, skilled, and prominent candidates. Without organizational backing or personal wealth, a black man with a funny name, I was considered a long shot. And so when I won, garnering a majority of votes in white areas as well as black, in the suburbs as well as Chicago, the reaction that followed echoed the response to my election to the Law Review. Mainstream commentators expressed genuine hope that my victory signaled a broader change in our racial politics. Within the black community, there is a sense of pride regarding my accomplishment, a pride mingled with frustration that 50 years after Brown v. Board of Education and 40 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, we should still be celebrating the fact that I am the sole African American, and only the third since Reconstruction, to serve in the Senate. My family, friends, and I are mildly bewildered by the attention, and constantly aware of the gulf between the hard sheen of media reports and the messy, mundane realities of life as it is truly lived. Just as that spate of publicity prompted my publisher's interest a decade ago, so has this fresh round of news clippings encouraged the book's republication. For the first time in many years, I've pulled out a copy and read a few chapters to see how much my voice may have changed over time. I confess to wincing ever so often at a poorly chosen word, a mangled sentence, an expression of emotion that seems indulgent or overly practiced. But I cannot honestly say that the voice in this book is not mine, that I would tell the story much differently today than I did 10 years ago, even if certain passages have proven to be inconvenient politically, the grist for political commentary and opposition research. What has changed, of course, dramatically, decisively, is the context in which the book might now be read. I began writing against a backdrop of Silicon Valley and a booming stock market, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, Mandela, in slow, sturdy steps, emerging from prison to lead a country, the signing of peace accords in Oslo. Domestically, our cultural debates around guns and abortion and rap lyrics seemed so fierce precisely because Bill Clinton's third way, a scaled-back welfare state without grand ambition but without sharp edges, seemed to describe a broad underlying consensus on bread-and-butter issues, a consensus to which even George W. Bush's first campaign, with its compassionate conservatism, would have to give a nod. Internationally, writers announced the end of history, the ascendance of free markets and liberal democracy, the replacement of old hatreds and wars between nations with virtual communities and battles for market share. And then, on September 11th, 2001, the world fractured. It's beyond my skill as a writer to capture that day and the days that would follow. The planes, like specters, vanishing into steel and glass, the slow-motion cascade of towers crumbling into themselves, the ash-covered figures wandering the streets, the anguish and the fear. Nor do I pretend to understand the stark nihilism that drove the terrorists that day and that drives their brethren still. My powers of empathy, my ability to reach into another's heart, cannot penetrate the blank stares of those who would murder innocence with abstract, serene satisfaction. What I do know is that history returned that day with a vengeance, that in fact, as Faulkner reminds us, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. This collective history, this past, directly touches my own. Not merely because the bombs of Al-Qaeda have marked, with an eerie precision, some of the landscapes of my life, the buildings and roads and faces of Nairobi, Bali, Manhattan. Not merely because, as a consequence of 9/11, my name is an irresistible target of mocking websites from overzealous Republican operatives, but also because the underlying struggle between worlds of plenty and worlds of want, between the modern and the ancient, between those who embrace our teeming, colliding, irksome diversity, while still insisting on a set of values that binds us together, and those who would seek, under whatever flag or slogan or sacred text, a certainty and simplification that justifies cruelty toward those not like us, is the struggle set forth on a miniature scale in this book. I know, I have seen, the desperation and disorder of the powerless, how it twists the lives of children on the streets of Jakarta or Nairobi in much the same way as it does the lives of children on Chicago's South Side, how narrow the path is for them between humiliation and untrammeled fury, how easily they slip into violence and despair. I know that the response of the powerful to this disorder, alternating as it does between a dull complacency and, when the disorder spills out of its prescribed confines, a steady, unthinking application of force, of longer prison sentences, and more sophisticated military hardware, is inadequate to the task. I know that the hardening of lines, the embrace of fundamentalism and tribe, dooms us all. And so, what was more an interior, intimate effort on my part, to understand this struggle and to find my place in it, has converged with a broader public debate, a debate in which I am professionally engaged, one that will shape our lives and the lives of our children for many years to come. The policy implications of all this are a topic for another book. Let me end this preface instead on a more personal note. Most of the characters in this book remain a part of my life, albeit in varying degrees, a function of work, children, geography, and turns of fate. The exception is my mother, whom we lost with a brutal swiftness to cancer a few months after this book was originally published. She had spent the previous 10 years doing what she loved. She traveled the world, working in the distant villages of Asia and Africa, helping women buy a sewing machine or a milk cow or an education that might give them a foothold in the world's economy. She gathered friends from high and low, took long walks, stared at the moon, and foraged through the local markets of Delhi or Marrakesh for some trifle, a scarf or a stone carving that would make her laugh or please the eye. She wrote reports, read novels, pestered her children, and dreamed of grandchildren. We saw each other frequently, our bond unbroken. During the writing of this book, she would read the drafts, correcting stories that I had misunderstood, careful not to comment on my characterizations of her, but quick to explain or defend the less flattering aspects of my father's character. She managed her illness with grace and good humor, and she helped my sister and me push on with our lives, despite our dread, our denials, our sudden constrictions of the heart. I think sometimes that had I known she would not survive her illness, I might have written a different book. Less a meditation on the absent parent, more a celebration of the one who was the single constant in my life. In my daughters, I see her every day, her joy, her capacity for wonder. I won't try to describe how deeply I mourn her passing still. I know that she was the kindest, most generous spirit I have ever known, and that what is best in me, I owe to her. Dreams from My Father, A Story of Race and Inheritance. A few months after my 21st birthday, a stranger called to give me the news. I was living in New York at the time, on 94th between 2nd and 1st, part of that unnamed shifting border between East Harlem and the rest of Manhattan. The line was thick with static. "Betty! Betty, is this you?" "Yes, who's this?" "Yes, Betty, this is your Aunt Jane, in Nairobi. Can you hear me?" "I'm sorry, who'd you say you were?" "Aunt Jane, listen, Barry, your father is dead. He's killed in a car accident. Hello, can you hear me? I say your father is dead. Barry, please call your uncle in Boston and tell him. I can't talk now, okay, Barry? I will call you again." That was all. At the time of his death, my father remained a myth to me, both more and less than a man. He had left Hawaii back in 1963 when I was just 2. So that as a child I knew him only through the stories that my mother and grandparents told. I can still picture Gramps leaning back in his old stuffed chair after dinner, sipping whiskey and cleaning his teeth with the cellophane from his cigarette pack, recounting the time that my father almost threw a man off the Poly lookout because of a pipe. "See, your mom and dad decided to take this friend of his sightseeing around the island," my grandfather begins. "So they drove up to the lookout, and Barack was probably on the wrong side of the road the whole way over there. Your father was a terrible driver," my mother explains to me. "He'd end up on the left-hand side, the way the British drive, and if you said something, he'd just huff about silly American rules." "Well," my grandfather continues, "this particular time, they arrived in one piece, and they got out and stood out at the railing to admire the view. And Barack, he was puffing away on this pipe that I'd given him for his birthday, pointing out all the sights with the stem, like a sea captain." "Your father was really proud of this pipe," my mother interrupts again. "He'd smoke it all night while he studied. And sometimes, look, Ann, do you want to tell the story or are you going to let me finish?" "Sorry, Dad. Go ahead." "Anyway, this poor fella, he was another African student, wasn't he? Fresh off the boat. This poor kid must have been impressed with the way Barack was holding forth with this pipe, because he asked if he could give it a try. Your dad thought about it for a minute, and finally agreed. And as soon as the fella took his first puff, he started coughing up a fit. Coughed so hard that the pipe slipped out of his hand and dropped over the railing. 100 feet down the face of the cliff." Gramps stops to take another nip from his flask before continuing. "Well now, your dad was gracious enough to wait until his friend stopped coughing before he told him to climb over the railing and bring the pipe back. The man took one peek down this 90-degree incline and told Barack that he'd buy him a replacement." "Quite sensibly," Toot says from the kitchen. We call my grandmother Tutu, Toot for short. It means grandparent in Hawaiian, for she decided on the day I was born that she was still too young to be called Granny. Gramps scowls, but decides to ignore. "But Barack was adamant about getting his pipe back," Gramps continues, "because it was a gift and couldn't be replaced. So the fella took another look and shook his head again. And that's when your dad picked him clear off the ground and started dangling him off the railing." Gramps lets out a hoot and gives his knee a jovial slap. As he laughs, I imagine myself looking up at my father, dark against the brilliant sun, the transgressor's arms flailing about as he's held aloft, a fearsome vision of justice. "He wasn't really holding him over the railing, Dad," my mother says, looking at me with some concern, but Gramps takes another sip of whiskey and plows forward. "At this point, other people were starting to stare, and your mother was begging Barack to stop. I guess Barack's friend was just holding his breath and saying his prayers. Anyway, after a couple of minutes, your dad set the man back down on his feet, patted him on the back, and suggested, calm as you please, that they all go find themselves a beer. And don't you know, that's how your dad acted for the rest of the tour, like nothing happened. Of course, your mother was still pretty upset when they got home. fact, she was barely talking to your dad. Barack wasn't helping matters any either, because when your mother tried to tell us what had happened, he just shook his head and started to laugh. "Relax, Anna," he said to her. Your dad had this deep baritone, see, and this British accent. My grandfather tucks his chin into his neck at this point to capture the full effect. "Relax, Anna," he said. "I only wanted to teach the chop a lesson about the proper care of other people's property." Gramps would start to laugh again until he started to cough, and Toot would mutter under her breath that she supposed it was a good thing that my father had realized that dropping the pipe had just been an accident, because who knows what might have happened otherwise, and my mother would roll her eyes at me and say they were exaggerating. "Your father can be a bit domineering," my mother would admit with a hint of a smile, "but it's just that he's basically a very honest person. That makes him uncompromising sometimes." My mother preferred a gentler portrait of my father. She would tell the story of when he arrived to accept his Phi Beta Kappa key in his favorite outfit, jeans and an old knit shirt with a leopard print pattern. "Nobody told him it was this big honor," she explained, "so he walked in and found everyone standing around this elegant room dressed in tuxedos. It's the only time I ever saw him embarrassed." And Gramps, suddenly thoughtful, would start nodding to himself. "It's a fact, Bear," he would say. "Your dad could handle just about any situation that made everybody like him. Remember the time he had to sing at that international music festival? He agreed to sing some African songs, but when he arrived, it turned out to be this big to-do. And the woman who performed just before him was a semi-professional singer, a Hawaiian gal, with a full band to back her up. Anyone else would have stopped right there, you know, and explained that there had been some mistake. But not Barack. He got up and started singing in front of this big crowd, which is no easy feat, let me tell you. And he wasn't great, but he was so sure of himself that before you knew it, he was getting as much applause as anybody." My grandfather would shake his head and get out of his chair to flip on the TV set. "Now there's something you can learn from your dad," he would tell me. "Confidence, the secret to a man's success." That's how all the stories went. Compact, apocryphal, told in rapid succession in the course of one evening, then packed away for months, sometimes years, in my family's memory. Like the few photographs of my father that remained in the house, old black-and-white studio prints that I might run across while rummaging through the closets in search of Christmas ornaments or an old snorkel set. At the point where my own memories begin, my mother had already begun a courtship with the man who would become her second husband, and I sensed, without explanation, why the photographs had to be stored away. The path of my father's life occupied the same terrain as a book my mother once bought for me, a book called Origins, a collection of creation tales from around the world. Stories of Genesis and the tree where man was born, Prometheus and the gift of fire, the tortoise of Hindu legend that floated in space, supporting the weight of the world on its back. Later, when I became more familiar with the narrower path of happiness to be found in television and the movies, I became troubled by questions. What supported the tortoise? Why did an omnipotent God let a snake cause such grief? Why didn't my father return? But at the age of 5 or 6, I was satisfied to leave these distant mysteries intact, each story self-contained and as true as the next, to be carried off into peaceful dreams. That my father looked nothing like the people around me, that he was black as pitch, my mother white as milk, barely registered in my mind. In fact, I can recall only one story that dealt explicitly with the subject of race. As I got older, it would be repeated more often, as if it captured the essence of the morality tale that my father's life had become. According to the story, after long hours of study, my father had joined my grandfather and several other friends at a local Waikiki bar. Everyone was in a festive mood, eating and drinking to the sounds of slack-key guitar, when a white man abruptly announced to the bartender, loudly enough for everyone to hear, that he shouldn't have to drink good liquor next to a nigger. The room fell quiet, and people turned to my father expecting a fight. Instead, my father stood up, walked over to the man, smiled, and proceeded to lecture him about the folly of bigotry, the promise of the American dream, and the universal rights of man. "This fella felt so bad when Barack was finished," Gramps would say, "that he reached into his pocket and gave Barack $100 on the spot, paid for all our drinks and poo-poos for the rest of the night, and your dad's rent for the rest of the month." By the time I was a teenager, I'd grown skeptical of this story's veracity and had set it aside with the rest. Until I received a phone call, many years later, from a Japanese-American man who said he had been my father's classmate in Hawaii and now taught at a Midwestern university. He was very gracious, a bit embarrassed by his own impulsiveness. He explained that he had seen an interview of me in his local paper and that the sight of my father's name had brought back a rush of memories. Then, during the course of our conversation, he repeated the same story that my grandfather had told, about the white man who had tried to purchase my father's forgiveness. "I'll never forget that," the man said to me over the phone, and in his voice I heard the same note I'd heard from Gramps so many years before, that note of disbelief and hope. Miscegenation. The word is humpbacked, ugly, portending a monstrous outcome, like antebellum or octoroon. It evokes images of another era, a distant world of horse whips and flames, dead magnolias and crumbling porticos. And yet it wasn't until 1967, the year I celebrated my sixth birthday, and Jimi Hendrix performed at Monterey, 3 years after Dr. King received the Nobel Peace Prize, a time when America had already begun to weary of black demands for equality, the problem of discrimination presumably solved, that the Supreme Court of the United States would get around to telling the state of Virginia that its ban on interracial marriages violated the Constitution. In 1960, the year that my parents were married, miscegenation still described a felony in over half the states in the Union. In many parts of the South, my father could have been strung up from a tree for merely looking at my mother the wrong way. In the most sophisticated of northern cities, the hostile stares, the whispers, might have driven a woman in my mother's predicament into a back-alley abortion, or at the very least to a distant convent that could arrange for adoption. Their very image together would have been considered lurid and perverse, a handy retort to the handful of soft-headed liberals who supported a civil rights agenda. Sure, but would you let your daughter marry one? The fact that my grandparents had answered yes to this question, no matter how grudgingly, remains an enduring puzzle to me. There was nothing in their background to predict such a response, no New England transcendentalists or wild-eyed socialists in their family tree. True, Kansas had fought on the Union side of the Civil War. Gramps liked to remind me that various strands of the family contained ardent abolitionists. If asked, Toot would turn her head in profile to show off her beaked nose, which, along with a pair of jet-black eyes, was offered as proof of Cherokee blood. But an old sepia-tone photograph on the bookshelf spoke most eloquently of their roots. It showed Toot's grandparents, of Scottish and English stock, standing in front of a ramshackle homestead, unsmiling and dressed in coarse wool, their eyes squinting at the sun-baked, flinty life that stretched out before them. Theirs were the faces of American Gothic, the WASP bloodline's poorer cousins, and in their eyes one could see the truth that I would have to learn later as facts, that Kansas had entered the Union free only after a violent precursor to the Civil War, the battle in which John Brown's sword tasted first blood, that while one of my great-great-grandfathers, Christopher Columbus Clark, had been a decorated Union soldier, his wife's mother was rumored to have been a second cousin of Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, that although another distant ancestor had indeed been a full-blooded Cherokee, such lineage was a source of considerable shame to Toot's mother, who blanched whenever someone mentioned the subject and hoped to carry the secret to her grave. That was the world in which my grandparents had been raised, the dab-smack, landlocked center of the country, a place where decency and endurance and the pioneer spirit were joined at the hip with conformity and suspicion and the potential for unblinking cruelty. They'd grown up less than 20 miles away from each other, my grandmother in Augusta, my grandfather in El Dorado, towns too small to warrant boldface on a road map. And the childhoods they liked to recall for my benefit portrayed small-town, Depression-era America in all its innocent glory. 4th of July parades and the picture shows on the side of a barn, fireflies in a jar and the taste of vine-ripe tomatoes sweet as apples, dust storms and hail storms and classrooms filled with farm boys who got sewn into their woolen underwear at the beginning of winter and stank like pigs as the months wore on. Even the trauma of bank failures and farm foreclosures seemed romantic when spun through the loom of my grandparents' memories, a time when hardship, the great leveler that had brought people closer together, was shared by all. So you had to listen carefully to recognize the subtle hierarchies and unspoken codes that had policed their early lives, the distinctions of people who don't have a lot and live in the middle of nowhere. It had to do with something called respectability. There were respectable people and not so respectable people, and although you didn't have to be rich to be respectable, you sure had to work harder at it if you weren't. Toot's family was respectable. Her father held a steady job all through the Depression, managing an oil lease for Standard Oil. Her mother had taught normal school before the children were born. The family kept their house spotless and ordered great books through the mail. They read the Bible, but generally shunned the tent revival circuit, preferring a straight-backed form of Methodism that valued reason over passion and temperance over both. My grandfather's station was more troublesome. Nobody was sure why. The grandparents who had raised him and his older brother weren't very well off, but they were decent, God-fearing Baptists, supporting themselves with work in the oil rigs around Wichita. Somehow, though, Gramps had turned out a bit wild. Some of the neighbors pointed out his mother's suicide. It was my grandfather, after all, then only 8 years old, who had found her body. Other, less charitable souls would simply shake their heads. The boy takes after his philandering father, they would opine, the undoubtable cause of the mother's unfortunate demise. Whatever the reason, Gramps' reputation was apparently well-deserved. By the age of 15, he'd been thrown out of high school for punching the principal in the nose. For the next 3 years, he lived off odd jobs, hopping rail cars to Chicago, then California, then back again, dabbling in moonshine, cards, and women. As he liked to tell it, he knew his way around Wichita, where both his and Toot's families had moved by that time, and Toot doesn't contradict him. Certainly Toot's parents believed the stories they heard about the young man and strongly disapproved of the budding courtship. The first time Toot brought Gramps over to the house to meet the family, her father took one look at my grandfather's black, slicked back hair and his perpetual wise guy grin and offered his unvarnished assessment. "He looks like a wop." My grandmother didn't care. To her, a home economics major, fresh out of high school and tired of respectability, my grandfather must have cut a dashing figure. I sometimes imagine them, in every American town in those years before the war, him in baggy pants and a starched undershirt, brim hat cocked back on his head, offering a cigarette to this smart-talking girl with too much red lipstick and hair dyed blonde and legs nice enough to model hosiery for the local department store. He's telling her about the big cities, the endless highway, his imminent escape from the empty, dust-ridden plains where big plans mean a job as a bank manager and entertainment means an ice cream soda and a Sunday matinee, where fear and lack of imagination choke your dreams so that you already know on the day that you're born just where you'll die and who it is that'll bury you. He won't end up like that, my grandfather insists. He has dreams. He has plans. He will infect my grandmother with a great peripatetic itch that had brought both their forebears across the Atlantic and half of a continent so many years before. They eloped just in time for the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and my grandfather enlisted. And at this point, the story quickens in my mind, like one of those old movies that show a wall calendar's pages peeled back faster and faster by invisible hands, the headlines of Hitler and Churchill and Roosevelt and Normandy spinning wildly to the drone of bombing attacks, the voice of Edward R. Murrow on the BBC. I watch as my mother is born at an army base where Gramps is stationed. My grandmother is Rosie the Riveter, working on a bomber assembly line. My grandfather sloshes around in the mud of France, part of Patton's army. Gramps returned from the war never having seen real combat, and the family headed to California, where he enrolled at Berkeley under the GI Bill. But the classroom couldn't contain his ambitions, his restlessness, and so the family moved again, first back to Kansas, then through a series of small Texas towns, then finally to Seattle, where they stayed long enough for my mother to finish high school. Gramps worked as a furniture salesman. They bought a house and found themselves bridge partners. They were pleased that my mother proved bright in school, although when she was offered early admission into the University of Chicago, my grandfather forbade her to go, deciding that she was still too young to be living on her own. And that's where the story might have stopped. A home, a family, a respectable life. Except something must have still been gnawing at my grandfather's heart. I can imagine him standing at the edge of the Pacific, his hair prematurely gray, his tall, lanky frame bulkier now, looking out at the horizon until he could see it curve and still smelling, deep in his nostrils, the oil rigs and corn husks and hard-bitten lives that he thought he had left far behind. So that when the manager of the furniture company where he worked happened to mention that a new store was about to open in Honolulu, the business prospects seemed limitless there, what with statehood right around the corner. He would rush home that same day and talk my grandmother into selling their house and packing up yet again to embark on the final leg of their journey, west, towards the setting sun. He would always be like that, my grandfather, always searching for that new start, always running away from the familiar. By the time the family arrived in Hawaii, his character would have been fully formed, I think. The generosity and eagerness to please, the awkward mix of sophistication and provincialism, the rawness of emotion that could make him at once tactless and easily bruised. His was an American character, one typical of men of his generation, men who embraced the notion of freedom and individualism and the open road without always knowing its price, and whose enthusiasms could as easily lead to the cowardice of McCarthyism as to the heroics of World War II. Men who were both dangerous and promising precisely because of their fundamental innocence. Men prone, in the end, to disappointment. In 1960, though, my grandfather had not yet been tested. The disappointments would come later, and even then they would come slowly, without the violence that might have changed him, for better or for worse. In the back of his mind, he had come to consider himself something of a free thinker, bohemian even. He wrote poetry on occasion, listened to jazz, counted a number of Jews he'd met in the furniture business as his closest friends. In his only skirmish into organized religion, he would enroll the family in the local Unitarian Universalist congregation. He liked the idea that Unitarians drew on the scriptures of all the great religions. "It's like you get five religions in one," he would say. Toot would eventually dissuade him of his views on the church. "For Christ's sake, Stanley, religion's not supposed to be like buying breakfast cereal." But if my grandmother was more skeptical by nature, and disagreed with Gramps on some of his more outlandish notions, her stubborn independence, her own insistence on thinking something through for herself, generally brought them into rough alignment. All this marked them as vaguely liberal, although their ideas would never congeal into anything like a firm ideology. In this, too, they were American. And so, when my mother came home one day and mentioned a friend she had met at the University of Hawaii, an African student named Barack, their first impulse was to invite him over for dinner. The poor kid's probably lonely, Gramps would have thought, so far away from home. "Better take a look at him," Toot would have said to herself. When my father arrived at the door, Gramps might have been immediately struck by the African's resemblance to Nat King Cole, one of his favorite singers. I imagine him asking my father if he can sing, not understanding the mortified look on my mother's face. Gramps is probably too busy telling one of his jokes, or arguing with Toot over how to cook the steaks, to notice my mother reach out and squeeze the smooth, sinewy hand beside hers. Toot notices, but she's polite enough to bite her lip and offer dessert. Her instincts warn her against making a scene. When the evening is over, they'll both remark on how intelligent the young man seems, so dignified with the measured gestures, the graceful draping of one leg over another, and how about that accent? But would they let their daughter marry one? We don't know yet. The story to this point doesn't explain enough. The truth is that, like most white Americans at the time, they had never really given black people much thought. Jim Crow had made its way north into Kansas well before my grandparents were born, but at least around Wichita it appeared in its more informal, genteel form, without much of the violence that pervaded the Deep South. The same unspoken codes that governed life among whites kept contact between the races to a minimum. When black people appear at all in the Kansas of my grandparents' memories, the images are fleeting. Black men who come around the oil fields once in a while searching for work as hired hands. Black women taking in the white folks' laundry or helping clean white homes. Blacks are there but not there, like Sam the piano player or Beulah the maid or Amos and Andy on the radio. Shadowy, silent presences that elicit neither passion nor fear. It wasn't until my family moved to Texas, after the war, that questions of race began to intrude on their lives. During his first week on the job there, Gramps received some friendly advice from his fellow furniture salesman about serving black and Mexican customers. If the coloreds want to look at the merchandise, they need to come around after hours and arrange for their own delivery. Later, at the bank where she worked, Toot made the acquaintance of the janitor, a tall and dignified black World War II vet she remembers only as Mr. Reed. While the two of them chatted in the hallway one day, a secretary in the office stormed up and hissed that Toot should never, ever call no nigger mister. Not long afterward, Toot would find Mr. Reed in a corner of the building weeping quietly to himself. When she asked him what was wrong, he straightened his back, dried his eyes, and responded with a question of his own. "What have we ever done to be treated so mean?" My grandmother didn't have an answer that day, but the question lingered in her mind, one that she and Gramps would sometimes discuss once my mother had gone to bed. They decided that Toot would keep calling Mr. Reed Mr., although she understood, with a mixture of relief and sadness, the careful distance that the janitor now maintained whenever they passed each other in the halls. Gramps began to decline invitations from his co-workers to go out for a beer, telling them he had to go home to keep his wife happy. They grew inward, skittish, filled with a vague apprehension, as if they were permanent strangers in town. This bad new air hit my mother the hardest. She was 11 or 12 by this time, an only child just growing out of a bad case of asthma. The illness, along with the numerous moves, had made her something of a loner. Cheerful and easy-tempered, but prone to bury her head in a book or wander off on solitary walks. And Toot began to worry that this latest move had only made her daughter's eccentricities more pronounced. My mother made few friends at her new school. She was teased mercilessly for her name, Stanley Ann, one of Gramps' less judicious ideas. He had wanted a son. Stanley Steamer, they called her. Stan the Man. When Toot got home from work, she would usually find my mother alone in the front yard, swinging her legs off the porch or lying in the grass, pulled into some solitary world of her own. Except for one day. There was that one hot, windless day when Toot came home to find a crowd of children gathered outside the picket fence that surrounded their house. As Toot drew closer, she could make out the sound of mirthless laughter, the contortions of rage and disgust on the children's faces. The children were chanting in a high-pitched, alternating rhythm. "Nigger lover! Dirty Yankee! Nigger lover!" The children scattered when they saw Toot, but not before one of the boys had sent a stone in his hand sailing over the fence. Toot's eyes followed the stone's trajectory as it came to a rest at the foot of a tree. And there she saw the cause for all the excitement. My mother, and a black girl of about the same age, lying side by side on their stomachs in the grass, their skirts gathered up above their knees, their toes dug into the ground, their heads propped up on their hands, in front of one of my mother's books. From a distance, the two girls seemed perfectly serene beneath the leafy shade. It was only when Toot opened the gate that she realized the black girl was shaking, and my mother's eyes shone with tears. The girls remained motionless, paralyzed in their fear, until Toot finally leaned down and put her hand on both of their heads. "If you two are going to play," she said, "then for goodness sake, go inside. Come on, both of you." She picked up my mother and reached for the other girl's hand, but before she could say anything, the girl was in a full sprint, her long legs like a whippet's, as she vanished down the street. Gramps was beside himself when he heard what had happened. He interrogated my mother, wrote down names. The next day, he took the morning off from work to visit the school principal. He personally called the parents of some of the offending children to give them a piece of his mind, and from every adult that he spoke to, he received the same response. "You best talk to your daughter, Mr. Dunham. White girls don't play with coloreds in this town." It's hard to know how much weight to give these episodes, what permanent allegiances were made or broken, or whether they stand out only in the light of subsequent events. Whenever he spoke to me about it, Gramps would insist that the family left Texas in part because of their discomfort with such racism. Toot would be more circumspect. Once, when we were alone, she told me that they had moved from Texas only because Gramps wasn't doing particularly well on his job, and because a friend in Seattle had promised them something better. According to her, the word racism wasn't even in their vocabulary back then. "Your grandfather and I just figured we should treat people decently, Bear. That's all." She's wise that way, my grandmother, suspicious of overwrought sentiment or overblown claims, content with common sense. Which is why I tend to trust her account of events. It corresponds to what I know about my grandfather, his tendency to rewrite his history to conform with the image he wished for himself. And yet, I don't entirely dismiss Gramps' recollection of events as a convenient bit of puffery, another act of white revisionism. I can't, precisely because I know how strongly Gramps believed in his fictions, how badly he wanted them to be true, even if he didn't always know how to make them so. After Texas, I suspect that black people became a part of these fictions of his, the narrative that worked its way through his dreams. The condition of the black race, their pain, their wounds, would in his mind become merged with his own. The absent father and the hint of scandal, the mother who had gone away, the cruelty of other children, the realization that he was no fair-haired boy, that he looked like a wop. Racism was part of that past, his instincts told him. Part of convention and respectability and status, the smirks and whispers and gossip that had kept him on the outside looking in. Those instincts count for something, I think. For many white people of my grandfather's generation and background, the instincts ran in an opposite direction, the direction of the mob. And although Gramps' relationship with my mother was already strained by the time they reached Hawaii, she would never quite forgive his instability and often violent temper, and would grow ashamed of his crude, ham-fisted manners. It was this desire of his to obliterate the past, this confidence in the possibility of remaking the world from whole cloth, that proved to be his most lasting patrimony. Whether Gramps realized it or not, the sight of his daughter, with a black man, offered at some deep, unexplored level, a window into his own heart. Not that such self-knowledge, even if accessible, would have made my mother's engagement any easier for him to swallow. In fact, how and when the marriage occurred remains a bit murky, a bill of particulars that I've never quite had the courage to explore. There's no record of a real wedding, a cake, a ring, a giving away of the bride. No families were in attendance. It's not even clear that people back in Kansas were fully informed. Just a small civil ceremony, a justice of the peace. The whole thing seems so fragile in retrospect, so haphazard. And perhaps that's how my grandparents intended it to be, a trial that would pass, just a matter of time, so long as they maintained a stiff upper lip and didn't do anything drastic. If so, they miscalculated, not only my mother's quiet determination, but also the sway of their own emotions. First, the baby arrived, 8 pounds, 2 ounces, with 10 toes and 10 fingers, and hungry for food. What in the heck were they supposed to do? Then time and place began to conspire, transforming potential misfortune into something tolerable, even a source of pride. Sharing a few beers with my father, Gramps might listen to his new son-in-law sound off about politics or the economy, about far-off places like Whitehall or the Kremlin, and imagine himself seeing into the future. He would begin to read the newspapers more carefully, finding early reports of America's newfound integrationist creed, and decide in his mind that the world was shrinking, sympathies changing, that the family from Wichita had in fact moved to the forefront of Kennedy's new frontier and Dr. King's magnificent dream. How could America send men into space and still keep its black citizens in bondage? One of my earliest memories is of sitting on my grandfather's shoulders as the astronauts from one of the Apollo missions arrived at Hickam Air Force Base after a successful splashdown. I remember the astronauts in aviator glasses as being far away, barely visible through the portal of an isolation chamber. But Gramps would always swear that one of the astronauts waved just at me and that I waved back. It was part of the story he told himself. With his black son-in-law and his brown grandson, Gramps had entered the space age. And what better port for setting off on this new adventure than Hawaii, the Union's newest member? Even now, with the state's population quadrupled, with Waikiki jammed wall-to-wall, with fast food emporiums and pornographic video stores, and subdivisions marching relentlessly into every fold of Green Hill, I can retrace the first steps I took as a child and be stunned by the beauty of the islands. The trembling blue plain of the Pacific, the moss-covered cliffs, and cool rush of Manoa Falls, with its ginger blossoms and high canopies filled with the sound of invisible birds. The North Shore's thunderous waves, crumbling as if in a slow-motion reel. The shadows off Polly's Peaks. The sultry, scented air. There was only one problem. My father was missing, and nothing that my mother or grandparents could tell me could obviate that single unassailable fact. Their stories didn't tell me why he had left. They couldn't describe what it might have been like had he stayed. Like the janitor, Mr. Reed, or the black girl who churned up dust as she raced down a Texas road, my father became a prop in someone else's narrative. An attractive prop, the alien figure with the heart of gold, the mysterious stranger who saves the town and wins the girl, but a prop nonetheless. I don't really blame my mother or grandparents for this. My father may have preferred the image they created for him. Indeed, he may have been complicit in his creation. In an article published in the Honolulu Star Bulletin upon his graduation, he appears guarded and responsible, the model student, ambassador for his continent. He mildly scolds the university for herding visiting students into dormitories and forcing them to attend programs designed to promote cultural understanding, a distraction, he says, from the practical training he seeks. Although he hasn't experienced any problems himself, he detects self-segregation and overt discrimination taking place between the various ethnic groups, and expresses wry amusement at the fact that Caucasians in Hawaii are occasionally at the receiving end of prejudice. But if his assessment is relatively clear-eyed, he is careful to end on a happy note. One thing other nations can learn from Hawaii, he says, is the willingness of races to work together towards common development, something he has found whites elsewhere too often unwilling to do. I discovered this article, folded away among my birth certificate and old vaccination forms, when I was in high school. It's a short piece with a photograph of him. No mention is made of me or my mother, and I'm left to wonder whether the omission was intentional on my father's part, in anticipation of his long departure. Perhaps the reporter failed to ask personal questions, intimidated by my father's imperious manner. Or perhaps it was an editorial decision, not part of the simple story they were looking for. I wondered, too, whether the omission caused a fight between my parents. I would not have known at the time, for I was too young to realize that I was supposed to have a live-in father, just as I was too young to know that I needed a race. For an improbably short span, it seems that my father fell under the same spell as my mother and her parents, and for the first 6 years of my life, even as that spell was broken and the worlds that they thought they'd left behind reclaimed each of them, I occupied the place where their dreams had been. The road to the embassy was choked with traffic. Cars, motorcycles, tricycle rickshaws, buses, and jitneys filled twice to their capacity, a procession of wheels and limbs all fighting for space in the mid-afternoon heat. We nudged forward a few feet, stopped, found an opening, stopped again. Our taxi driver shooed away a group of boys who were hawking gum and loose cigarettes, then barely avoided a motor scooter carrying an entire family on its back. Father, mother, son, and daughter, all leaning as one into a turn, their mouths wrapped with handkerchiefs to blunt the exhaust. A family of bandits. Along the side of the road, wizened brown women in faded brown sarongs stacked straw baskets high with ripening fruit, and a pair of mechanics squatted before their open-air garage, lazily brushing away flies as they took an engine apart. Behind them, the brown earth dipped into a smoldering dump, where a pair of round-headed tots frantically chased a scrawny black hen. The children slipped in the mud and corn husks and banana leaves, squealing with pleasure, until they disappeared down the dirt road beyond. Things eased up once we hit the highway, and the taxi dropped us off in front of the embassy, where a pair of smartly dressed Marines nodded in greeting. Inside the courtyard, the clamor of the street was replaced by the steady rhythm of gardening clippers. My mother's boss was a portly black man with closely cropped hair, sprinkled gray at the temples. An American flag draped down in rich folds from the pole beside his desk. He reached out and offered a firm handshake. "How are you, young man?" He smelled of aftershave and his starched collar cut hard into his neck. I stood at attention as I answered his questions about the progress of my studies. The air in the office was cool and dry, like the air of mountain peaks, the pure and heady breeze of privilege. Our audience over, my mother sat me down in the library while she went off to do some work. I finished my comic books and the homework that my mother had made me bring, before climbing out of my chair to browse through the stacks. Most of the books held little interest for a 9-year-old boy. World Bank reports, geological surveys, 5-year development plans. But in one corner I found a collection of Life magazines neatly displayed in clear plastic binders. I thumbed through the glossy advertisements. Goodyear Tires and Dodge Fever, Zenith TV, why not the best? And Campbell's Soup, good. Men in white turtlenecks pouring Seagrams over ice as women in red miniskirts looked on admiringly, and felt vaguely reassured. When I came upon a news photograph, I tried to guess the subject of the story before reading the caption. The photograph of French children dashing over cobblestone streets. That was a happy scene, a game of hide-and-go-seek after a day of school books and chores. Their laughter spoke of freedom. The photograph of a Japanese woman cradling a young naked girl in a shallow tub. That was sad. The girl was sick, her legs twisted, her head fallen back against the mother's breast, the mother's face tight with grief. Perhaps she blamed herself. Eventually, I came across a photograph of an older man in dark glasses and a raincoat walking down an empty road. I couldn't guess what this picture was about. There seemed nothing unusual about the subject. On the next page, there was another photograph, this one a close-up of the same man's hands. They had a strange, unnatural pallor, as if blood had been drawn from the flesh. Turning back to the first picture, I now saw that the man's crinkly hair, his heavy lips and broad, fleshy nose, all had this same uneven, ghostly hue. He must be terribly sick, I thought. A radiation victim, maybe. Or an albino. I had seen one of those on a street a few days before, and my mother had explained about such things. Except when I read the words that went with the picture, that wasn't it at all. The man had received a chemical treatment, the article explained, to lighten his complexion. He had paid for it with his own money. He expressed some regret about trying to pass himself off as a white man, and was sorry about how badly things had turned out. But the results were irreversible. There were thousands of people like him, black men and women back in America, who'd undergone the same treatment in response to advertisements that promised happiness as a white person. I felt my face and neck get hot. My stomach knotted. The type began to blur on the page. Did my mother know about this? What about her boss? Why was he so calm reading through his reports a few feet down the hall? I had a desperate urge to jump out of my seat, to show them what I had learned, to demand some explanation or assurance. But something held me back. As in a dream, I had no voice for my newfound fear. By the time my mother came to take me home, my face wore a smile and the magazines were back in their proper place. The room, the air, was quiet as before. We had lived in Indonesia for over 3 years by that time, the result of my mother's marriage to an Indonesian named Lolo, another student she had met at the University of Hawaii. His name meant crazy in Hawaiian, which tickled Gramps to no end, but the meaning didn't suit the man, for Lolo possessed the good manners and easy grace of his people. He was short and brown, handsome, with thick black hair and features that could have as easily been Mexican or Samoan as Indonesian. His tennis game was good, his smile uncommonly even, and his temperament imperturbable. For 2 years, from the time that I was 4 until I was 6, he endured endless hours of chess with Gramps and long wrestling sessions with me. When my mother sat me down one day to tell me that Lolo had proposed and wanted us to move with him to a faraway place, I wasn't surprised and expressed no objections. I did ask if she loved him. I had been around long enough to know such things were important. My mother's chin trembled, as it still does when she's fighting back tears, and she pulled me into a long hug that made me feel very brave, although I wasn't sure why. Lolo left Hawaii quite suddenly after that, and my mother and I spent months in preparation, passports, visas, plane tickets, hotel reservations, an endless series of shots. While we packed, my grandfather pulled out an atlas and ticked off the names in Indonesia's island chain, Java, Borneo, Sumatra, Bali. He remembered some of the names, he said, from reading Joseph Conrad as a boy. The Spice Islands, they were called back then. Enchanted names, shrouded in mystery. Says here they still got tigers over there, he said. And orangutans. He looked up from the book and his eyes widened. Says here they've even got headhunters. Meanwhile, Toot called the State Department to find out if the country was stable. Whoever she spoke to there informed her that the situation was under control. Still, Toot insisted that we packed several trunks full of foodstuffs, tang, powdered milk, cans of sardines. You never know what these people will eat, she said firmly. My mother sighed, but Toot tossed in several boxes of candy to win me over to her side. Finally, we boarded a Pan Am jet for our flight around the globe. I wore a long-sleeve white shirt and a gray clip-on tie, and the stewardess plied me with puzzles and extra peanuts and a set of metal pilot's wings that I wore over my breast pocket. On a 3-day stopover in Japan, we walked through bone-chilling rains to see the great bronze Buddha at Kamakura and ate green tea ice cream on a ferry that passed through high mountain lakes. In the evenings, my mother studied flashcards. Walking off the plane in Jakarta, the tarmac rippling with heat, the sun bright as a furnace, I clutched her hand, determined to protect her from whatever might come. Lolo was there to greet us, a few pounds heavier, a bushy mustache now hovering over his smile. He hugged my mother, hoisted me up into the air, and told us to follow a small, wiry man who was carrying our luggage, straight past the long line at customs and into an awaiting car. The car was borrowed, Lolo told us, but he had bought a brand new motorcycle, a Japanese make, but good enough for now. The new house was finished, just a few touch-ups remained to be done. I was already enrolled in a nearby school, and the relatives were anxious to meet us. As he and my mother talked, I stuck my head out the backseat window and stared at the passing landscape, brown and green uninterrupted, villages falling back into forest, the smell of diesel oil and wood smoke. Men and women stepped like cranes through the rice paddies, their faces hidden by their wide straw hats. A boy, wet and slick as an otter, sat on the back of a dumb-faced water buffalo, whipping its haunches with a stick of bamboo. The streets became more congested, small stores and markets and men pulling carts loaded with gravel and timber. Then the buildings grew taller, like buildings in Hawaii. Hotel Indonesia, very modern, Lolo said, and the new shopping center, white and gleaming. But only a few were higher than the trees that now cooled the road. When we passed a row of big houses with high hedges and sentry posts, my mother said something I couldn't entirely make out, something about the government and a man named Sukarno. "Who's Sukarno?" I shouted from the back seat, but Lolo appeared not to hear me. Instead, he touched my arm and motioned ahead of us. "Look," he said, pointing upward. There, standing astride the road, was a towering giant at least 10 stories tall, with the body of a man and the face of an ape. "That's Hanuman," Lolo said as we circled the statue, "the monkey god." I turned around in my seat, mesmerized by the solitary figure, so dark against the sun, poised to leap into the sky as puny traffic swirled around its feet. "He's a great warrior," Lolo said firmly, "strong as 100 men. When he fights the demons, he's never defeated." The house was in a still-developing area on the outskirts of town. The road ran over a narrow bridge that spanned a wide brown river. As we passed, I could see villagers bathing and washing clothes along the steep banks below. The road then turned from tarmac to gravel to dirt as it wound past small stores and whitewashed bungalows until it finally petered out into the narrow footpath of the kampong. The house itself was modest, stucco and red tile, but it was open and airy, with a big mango tree and a small courtyard in front. As we passed through the gate, Lolo announced that he had a surprise for me, but before he could explain, we heard a deafening howl from high up in the trees. My mother and I jumped back with a start and saw a big hairy creature with a small flat head and long menacing arms drop into a low branch. "A monkey!" I shouted. "An ape," my mother corrected. Lolo drew a peanut from his pocket and handed it to the animal's grasping fingers. "His name is Tata," he said. "I brought him all the way from New Guinea for you." I started to step forward to get a closer look, but Tata threatened to lunge, his dark-ringed eyes fierce and suspicious. I decided to stay where I was. "Don't worry," Lolo said, handing Tata another peanut. "He's on a leash. Come, there's more." I looked up at my mother, and she gave me a tentative smile. In the backyard, we found what seemed like a small zoo. Chickens and ducks running every which way, a big yellow dog with a baleful howl, 2 birds of paradise, a white cockatoo, and finally 2 baby crocodiles, half submerged in a fenced-off pond towards the edge of the compound. Lolo stared down at the reptiles. "There were 3, he said, "but the biggest one crawled out through a hole in the fence, slipped into somebody's rice field and ate one of the man's ducks. We had to hunt it by torchlight." There wasn't much light left, but we took a short walk down the mud path into the village. Groups of giggling neighborhood children waved from their compounds, and a few barefoot old men came up to shake our hands. We stopped at the common, where one of Lolo's men was grazing a few goats, and a small boy came up beside me holding a dragonfly that hovered at the end of a string. When we returned to the house, the man who had carried our luggage was standing in the backyard with a rust-colored hen tucked under his arm and a long knife in his right hand. He said something to Lolo, who nodded, and called over to my mother and me. My mother told me to wait where I was and sent Lolo a questioning glance. "Don't you think he's a little young?" my mother said. Lolo shrugged and looked down at me. "The boy should know where his dinner is coming from. What do you think, Barry?" I looked at my mother, then turned back to face the man holding the chicken. Lolo nodded again, and I watched the man set the bird down, pinning it gently under one knee and pulling its neck out across a narrow gutter. For a moment, the bird struggled, beating its wings hard against the ground, a few feathers dancing up with the wind. Then it grew completely still. The man pulled the blade across the bird's neck in a single smooth motion. Blood shot out in a long crimson ribbon. The man stood up, holding the bird far away from his body, and suddenly tossed it into the air. It landed with a thud, then struggled to its feet, its head lolling grotesquely against its side, its legs pumping wildly in a wide, wobbly circle. I watched as the circle grew smaller, the blood trickling down to a gurgle, until finally the bird collapsed, lifeless on the grass. Lolo rubbed his hand across my head and told me and my mother to go wash up before dinner. The 3 of us ate quietly, under a dim yellow bulb, chicken stew and rice, and then a dessert of red, hairy-skinned fruit so sweet at the center that only a stomachache could make me stop. Later, lying alone beneath a mosquito net canopy, I listened to crickets chirp under the moonlight and remembered the last twitch of life that I'd witnessed a few hours before. I could barely believe my good fortune. The first thing to remember is how to protect yourself. Lolo and I faced off in the backyard. A day earlier, I had shown up at the house with an egg-sized lump on the side of my head. Lolo had looked up from washing his motorcycle and asked me what had happened, and I told him about my tussle with an older boy who lived down the road. The boy had run off with my friend's soccer ball, I said, in the middle of our game. When I chased after him, the boy picked up a rock. It wasn't fair, I said, my voice choking with aggrievement. He had cheated. Lolo had parted my hair with his fingers and silently examined the wound. It's not bleeding, he said finally, before returning to his chrome. I thought that had ended the matter. But when Lolo came home from work the next day, he had with him two pairs of boxing gloves. They smelled of new leather, the larger pair black, the smaller pair red, the laces tied together and thrown over his shoulder. He now finished tying the laces on my gloves and stepped back to examine his handiwork. My hands dangled at my sides like bulbs at the end of thin stalks. He shook his head and raised the gloves to cover my face. There, he said. Keep your hands up. He adjusted my elbows, then crouched into a stance and started to bob. You want to keep moving, but always stay low. Don't give them a target. How does that feel? I nodded, copying his movements as best I could. After a few minutes, he stopped and held his palm up in front of my nose. Okay, he said. Let's see your swing. This I could do. I took a step back, wound up, and delivered my best shot. His hand barely wobbled. Not bad, Lolo said. He nodded to himself, his expression unchanged. Not bad at all. Ah, but look where your hands are now. What did I tell you? Get them up. I raised my arms, throwing soft jabs at Lolo's palm, and glanced up at him every so often. I realized how familiar his face had become after our 2 years, as familiar as the earth on which we stood. It had taken me less than 6 months to learn Indonesia's language, its customs, and its legends. I had survived chickenpox, measles, and the sting of my teacher's bamboo switches. The children of farmers, servants, and low-level bureaucrats had become my best friends, and together we ran the streets morning and night, hustling odd jobs, catching crickets, battling swift kites with razor-sharp lines. The loser watched his kite soar off with the wind and knew that somewhere other children had formed a long, wobbly train, their heads toward the sky, waiting for their prize to land. With Lolo, I had learned how to eat small green chili peppers raw with dinner, plenty of rice, and away from the dinner table, I was introduced to dog meat, tough, snake meat, tougher, and roasted grasshopper, crunchy. Like many Indonesians, Lolo followed a brand of Islam that could make room for the remnants of more ancient animist and Hindu faiths. He explained that a man took on the powers of whatever he ate. One day soon, he promised, he would bring home a piece of tiger meat for us to share. That's how things were, one long adventure, the bounty of a young boy's life. In letters to my grandparents, I would faithfully record many of these events, confident that more civilizing packages of chocolate and peanut butter would surely follow. But not everything made its way into my letters. Some things I found too difficult to explain. I didn't tell Toot and Gramps about the face of the man who had come to our door one day, with a gaping hole where his nose should have been, the whistling sound he made as he asked my mother for food. Nor did I mention the time that one of my friends told me in the middle of recess that his baby brother had died the night before of an evil spirit brought in by the wind, the terror that had danced in my friend's eyes for the briefest of moments before he let out a strange laugh and punched my arm and broke into a breathless run. There was the empty look on the face of the farmers the year the rains never came, the stoop in their shoulders as they wandered barefoot through their barren, cracked fields, bending over every so often to crumble earth between their fingers. And their desperation the following year, when the rains lasted for over a month, swelling the rivers and fields until the streets gushed with water and swept as high as my waist, and families scrambled to rescue their goats and their hens, even as chunks of their huts washed away. The world was violent, I was learning, unpredictable, and often cruel. My grandparents knew nothing about such a world, I decided. There was no point in disturbing them with questions they couldn't answer. Sometimes, when my mother came home from work, I would tell her things I had seen or heard, and she would stroke my forehead, listening intently, trying her best to explain what she could. I always appreciated the attention. Her voice, the touch of her hand, defined all that was secure. But her knowledge of floods and exorcisms and cockfights left much to be desired. Everything was as new to her as it was to me, and I would leave such conversations feeling that my questions had only given her unnecessary cause for concern. So it was to Lolo that I turned for guidance and instruction. He didn't talk much, but he was easy to be with. With his family and friends, he introduced me as his son, but he never pressed things beyond matter-of-fact advice or pretended that our relationship was more than it was. I appreciated this distance. It implied a manly trust. And his knowledge of the world seemed inexhaustible. Not just how to change a flat tire or open in chess. He knew more elusive things, ways of managing the emotions I felt, ways to explain fate's constant mysteries. Like how to deal with beggars. They seemed to be everywhere, a gallery of ills, men, women, children in tattered clothing matted with dirt, some without arms, others without feet, victims of scurvy or polio or leprosy, walking on their hands or rolling down the crowded sidewalks in jerry-built carts, their legs twisted behind them like contortionists. At first, I watched my mother give over her money to anyone who stopped at our door or stretched out an arm as we passed on the streets. Later, when it became clear that the tide of pain was endless, she gave more selectively, learning to calibrate the levels of misery. Lolo thought her moral calculations endearing but silly, and whenever he caught me following her example with the few coins in my possession, he would raise his eyebrows and take me aside. "How much money do you have?" he would ask. I'd empty my pocket. 30 rupiah? How many beggars are there on the street? I tried to imagine the number that had come by the house in the last week. "You see," he said, once it was clear I'd lost count. "Better to save your money and make sure you don't end up on the street yourself." He was the same way about servants. They were mostly young villagers, newly arrived in the city, often working for families not much better off than themselves, sending money to their people back in the country or saving enough to start their own businesses. If they had ambition, Lolo was willing to help them get their start, and he would generally tolerate their personal idiosyncrasies. For over a year, he employed a good-natured young man who liked to dress up as a woman on weekends. Lolo loved the man's cooking, but he would fire the servants without compunction if they were clumsy or forgetful or otherwise cost him money, and he would be baffled when either my mother or I tried to protect them from his judgment. "Your mother has a soft heart," Lolo would tell me one day after my mother tried to take the blame for knocking a radio off the dresser. "That's a good thing in a woman. But you will be a man someday, and a man needs to have more sense." It had nothing to do with good or bad, he explained, like or dislike. It was a matter of taking life on its own terms. I felt a hard knock to the jaw and looked up at Lolo's sweating face. "Pay attention," he said. "Keep your hands up." We sparred for another half hour before Lolo decided it was time for a rest. My arms burned. My head flashed with a dull, steady throb. We took a jug full of water and sat down near the crocodile pond. "Tired?" he asked. I slumped forward, barely nodding. He smiled and rolled up one of his pants legs to scratch his calf. I noticed a series of indented scars that ran up his ankle, halfway up his shin. "What are those?" I asked. "Leech marks," he said, "from when I was in New Guinea. They crawl inside your army boots while you're hiking through the swamps. At night, when you take off your socks, they're stuck there, fat with blood. You sprinkle salt on them, and they die, but you still have to dig them out with a hot knife." I ran my finger over one of the oval grooves. It was smooth and hairless where the skin had been singed. I asked Lolo if it had hurt. "Of course it hurt," he said, taking a sip from the jug. "Sometimes you can't worry about hurt. Sometimes you worry only about getting where you have to go." We fell silent, and I watched him out of the corner of my eye. I realized then that I had never heard him talk about what he was feeling. I had never seen him really angry or sad. He seemed to inhabit a world of hard surfaces and well-defined thoughts. A queer notion suddenly sprang into my head. "Have you ever seen a man killed?" I asked him. He glanced down, surprised by the question. "Have you?" I asked again. "Yes," he said. "Was it bloody?" "Yes." I thought for a moment. "Why was the man killed? The one you saw?" "Because he was weak." "That's all?" Lolo shrugged and rolled his pants leg back down. That's usually enough. Men take advantage of weakness in other men. They're just like countries in that way. The strong man takes the weak man's land. He makes the weak man work in his fields. If the weak man's woman is pretty, the strong man will take her. He paused to take another sip of water, then asked, "Which would you rather be?" I didn't answer, and Lolo squinted up at the sky. "Better to be strong," he said finally, rising to his feet. "If you can't be strong, be clever and make peace with someone who's strong. But always better to be strong yourself. Always."